May the words of my mouth and the meditation of all our hearts be now and always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Well, a few of you may have seen the June edition of the Algoma Anglican. That's our diocesan newspaper. And in that edition, Bishop Stephen wrote a letter that has, as they say, somewhat stirred the pot. The stirring started with the title of his letter, which was, Is Christ Present in Our Fellowship? And some of us might bristle at that and say, well, of course. Well, what matters most, our bishop reminded us, is having a relationship with Jesus Christ. That's what matters most about the church. That's what we're all about. Now, few would argue with that, I hope, or be negatively stirred by that idea. But in reminding us of what matters most, our bishop also reminded us about what matters less, namely our buildings. He points out that Jerusalem's glorious temple was destroyed despite the meticulous upkeep and care it received. Now, don't make a judgment about his letter until and unless you read the whole thing for yourself. And actually, I've made photocopies of it, and they're available there for any who'd like to take it home and read his letter. I do commend it to you. But here's the quotation from our bishop's letter that has caused, in some people who've come to speak with me, some confusion and anxiety. Here's the quotation. God did not and does not need the temple. Neither does God need our church buildings. Now, I can understand why this idea, especially coming from a bishop, and especially when some of our Anglican congregations are worried that there is some secret agenda afoot to shut them down, might cause some anxiety. But Bishop Stephen's point is not that buildings are bad, nor that God cannot use them for his glory, but rather that God is much bigger than our buildings. God does not need the houses we build for him, beautiful though they may be. All that's needed for God's work to go forward are hearts that are willing to trust him and feet that are willing to follow him. As St. Paul wrote in Ephesians chapter 2, the church is ultimately a spiritual community, built not with bricks and mortar, but a dwelling place for God, built on the cornerstone of Jesus Christ himself. Well, God gave a similar message via the prophet Nathan to King David thousands of years ago. Having been made king over all Israel, and having brought the Ark of God back to Jerusalem, as we heard about last week, David now looks to settle in for the long term. David notes that he himself is living in a beautiful palace, but the Ark of God stays in a tent. So David, probably with the best of intentions, wanted to build a temple for the Lord. But God says, hold on. Here again, the word of the Lord to David through the prophet Nathan. I have not lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this day, but I have been moving about in a tent and a tabernacle. Wherever I have moved about among all the people of Israel, did I ever speak a word with any of the tribal leaders of Israel saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? You notice the phrase moved about is present twice there. Now, before anyone gets too upset, let's hear the end of our reading again, too, because although God does not need a building, he's not necessarily against them either. Indeed, David's son Solomon will make the glorious temple. Now, if you know the story of Solomon building the temple, you know that was not without its problems, but God does say Solomon will build a temple to his name. Here's God's message to David, picking up at verse 12. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring after you. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. You know, I've heard this passage used to decry church buildings, and I'm not trying to do that, although it is true that God says here he does not need a building, a temple to accomplish his purposes. He does, though, allow David's son to build a temple. So the subject of buildings, while interesting, only points to the real and larger meaning of this passage. And what is that? Well, I believe the larger meaning of this passage has to do with the sovereignty of God. Well, sovereignty. There's a big theological word, but it's a very important word, a word all Christians should try to understand. Now, the definition of sovereignty is actually pretty easy to grasp. It means what you think it means. To be sovereign is to possess supreme power and authority so that one is in complete control and can accomplish whatever he pleases. I'm going to read that again. So God is sovereign, and to be sovereign is to possess supreme power and authority so that one is in complete control and can accomplish whatever he pleases. God's caution to David in today's reading is not so much about the temple. It's about David's presumption that he can tame a sovereign, freely moving God. I'll never forget a certain episode of The Simpsons. This is the one when Homer finds himself a reluctant and very incompetent missionary, and he gets sent against his will to a tropical island's paradise to convert them. Now, as he and the islanders are building a chapel for church services, Homer surveys their work and then he says, "Well, I may not know much about God, but I have to say, we've built a pretty nice cage for him." David wants to build a house for God, but God says, "No, I will build a house for you." The house God will build for David is not one of cedar, but rather a dynasty, a royal line that God will faithfully bless and prosper. And while David wants to do God a favor, God turns the tables and reminds David of all God has done for him. Again, hear from what the prophet Nathan says, "I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, to be prince over my people Israel, and I have been with you wherever you went, and have cut up all your enemies from before you, and I will make for you a great name, like the great ones of the earth." See, the problem is David is getting ahead of himself here. More importantly, he's getting ahead of God. And God says, "Hang on, you may be king over Israel, but I am king over all creation. God is sovereign." But what does this mean for us? Theology, even something as important as God's sovereignty, doesn't mean much to us unless we can understand where it hits our own lives and circumstances. So quickly, here are three applications for us about what God's sovereignty means for our faith and what comes out of this week's King David story. First of all, because God is sovereign, fully, freely himself, we cannot pick and choose only those aspects of God's character that we like. What do I mean by that? Well, there's a saying that goes something like this: God created man in his own image, and man has been trying to repay the favor ever since. When we say things like, "I believe in God's love, but I don't believe God has the right to get angry," we are picking and choosing. Or when we say, as many say these days, "I like God in my private life, but I don't want to have anything to do with the church," we are picking and choosing. If God is sovereign, that means God is who God is, no matter what we think or feel about it. So if we want to follow Jesus, we must be willing to admit his control and not try to assert our own. I think we've told a couple of you that Paul and I will be bringing home a new puppy. Now don't worry, by puppy I mean puppy, not a new baby. And in picking our puppy, we had to think about our family circumstances and what we needed. So for example, Paul's parents are allergic to dogs, and so we needed something that was more or less hypoallergenic. We also needed a dog that's good with children and one that's fairly easy to train. So we did the research and talked it up, and we've decided to adopt a golden doodle. This is a hybrid, a golden retriever mixed with a standard poodle. Now, when adopting a new puppy, you can pick and choose. And that's what we did, picking and choosing, mixing up two breeds to get the result we want. You can do that when it comes to puppies. You can't do that when it comes to God. God reveals himself to us as he is, not only as we would like him to be, not only as we can make him fit into our lives. God is not a golden doodle. God is sovereign. So the first application is that if God is sovereign, we can't pick and choose things about God we like and leave the rest. Secondly, because God is sovereign, he may throw us a curveball now and then in our lives, but his plans for us are always better than the plans we make for ourselves. This was King David's experience in today's reading. He wants to build a house for God. That's his plan. Instead, God builds a house for him. Now, we might say this was a very welcome curveball for David, one very easy for him to accept. I mean, who's going to say no to a dynasty, right? But in fact, not being allowed to build the temple in his lifetime would have been difficult for King David. Because in the world David lived in, a nation's gods were not seen as legitimate unless they had a temple, unless they had some kind of permanent residence. If you didn't have a temple to your god, it meant your god was puny and weak or didn't exist at all. And so David wants to build the temple not only out of religious piety, and I don't doubt his sincerity here, but also as a show of Israel's power to the other nations. God, Israel's God is powerful, he wants to say, and the temple will show that. But God says, wait, a temple will come, but David will not be the one to build it. That means that for his whole life, David must trust that God is going to display his power to the nations in other ways, and that God will lead him in other ways. And of course, God is faithful to do that. And we too, when God throws us a curveball, are called to trust that because God is sovereign, his plans for us and for this world will still be accomplished. Third and finally, because God is sovereign, we can worship him with no reservations. Well, what do I mean by that? Often the doctrine of sovereignty, this definition of God as sovereign I've given to you, is hard for us to swallow. And you know, I struggle with it myself. The difficulty is this. If God is fully in charge and fully powerful and can accomplish whatever he pleases, then that leads us to all kinds of questions about suffering, doesn't it? If God is sovereign, then why doesn't he do something more about the state of this world? Recent shootings at neighborhood barbecues and movie theaters come to mind, but there's always something to fuel our questions about human suffering. This is a very common and deeply felt concern. And because it's so deeply felt and bothersome, it can be easier for us to believe not in a sovereign God, but rather in a limited God. Because if God's power is limited, then that explains a lot, doesn't it? And so some begin to talk about God being limited by the laws of nature, or by the choices that people make, or even by his own gift to us of free will. Now, it's true that sometimes God chooses to say no, even to himself, about what he will or won't do. For example, after Noah's great flood, God promised never to destroy the earth by water again. And in the psalm we read today, God promises eternal faithfulness to David, no matter what David does. But just because God chooses to restrain himself does not mean that God is limited. And as much as the question of suffering still bothers me, I have come to understand that a limited God is only worthy of limited worship. And a God like that is not the God of the Bible, not the God revealed in the face of Jesus Christ. And so I choose to believe by faith that God is sovereign, and therefore God is worthy of all our worship and praise. King David was a man who knew and trusted in God. He wasn't perfect, but his life is testament to God's sovereignty. May we, like King David, learn to follow, trust, and worship the Lord for who he is, giving thanks that his plans are always bigger and better than anything we could ask or imagine. Amen.